Take the plunge and listen to Guernsey Deep Dive. Don't forget to like, share and follow.
You're here because you want to get to the heart of the matter, right? To understand these complex stories quickly, but also thoroughly.
Exactly. No getting lost in the weeds.
And that's what we're doing today. We're really plunging into a deeply tragic and honestly captivating series of events. Happened in Guernsey way back in 1556.
Yeah, this isn't just some, you know, dusty old footnote in history. It's a powerful human story. There's injustice, shocking brutality. Understanding it gives you a real insight into that turbulent time.
Absolutely. And the forces at play back then.
Yeah.
So for this, we've pulled together a few different sources. We've got the pretty harrowing account from John Fox's Book of Martyrs.
A classic, though controversial source sometimes.
True. We also have some background from Wikipedia, you know, for context, and a local church history, which helps keep this memory alive over there, plus an educational website laying out the timeline.
So quite a range to work with.
Right. Our mission, if you like, for this deep dive is to really unpack what happened to these individuals. Three women and an infant, tragically.
Yeah.
Understand the context, the times they lived in, and maybe explore why this story, well, why it still hits so hard today.
So where do we kick this off? You mentioned it starts almost randomly.
It does seem that way. Mm. It all begins with the theft of a silver cup, May 1556, St. Peter's Port in Guernsey.
Okay.
A woman named Vincent Gossett, the source just calls her Naughty, steals this cup from a neighbor.
Right, a simple theft. But what happens next is odd.
It is. Gossett doesn't keep it. Instead, she takes it to another woman, Perrottine Massey. Seems Perrottine was quite well regarded. Gossett asks her for a loan, just sixpence, using the cup as collateral.
Okay, Perrottine Massey, she suspects something's up.
She does. She rightly figures the cup's probably stolen, so she refuses the loan. But she goes further. She knows who the real owner is.
Ah, so she returns it.
Exactly, takes it upon herself to return it. And she even gives Gossett the sixpence back anyway. Seems like just doing the right thing.
A straightforward, honest act. But you said this kicks things off.
Ironically, yes. This act of honesty seems to set the whole tragedy in motion. Because the very next day, a constable, Nicholas Carey, he's investigating Gossett's theft.
Makes sense.
And his investigation leads him to Perrottine's house. She lives there with her mother, Catherine Cotches, and her sister, Gillian Gilbert.
Okay, the whole family.
Yeah. And Carey doesn't find the silver cup. Of course, it's already been returned. But he does find an unmarked pewter vessel and a dish that has a name scratched off it.
Hmm. Not the stolen item, but suspicious enough for him.
Apparently.
Yeah.
Based on just these, you know, pretty minor things, all three women are arrested, and their possessions are inventoried straight away.
Wow, that escalated quickly. Just for a pewter pot and a scratch dish, what was their reaction?
Well, their response is quite telling, actually. They make this direct plea for justice. They basically say, look, if we've broken the law, let the law deal with us.
Fair enough.
But if we're innocent, then we ask for our rights as subjects. It's a very basic, fundamental appeal for fairness, you know?
Yeah, completely reasonable. What did the authorities or the community make of it?
Well, when their neighbors are questioned, they actually vouch for them, say they lived honestly, truly, like good Christian women.
So, cleared of theft by their own community.
Pretty much. But. There's always a but, isn't there? The neighbors made one crucial exception.
Ah, what was that?
They noted the women hadn't been attending church.
Ooh, okay. In the context of Mary in England, that's significant.
Very significant. Meanwhile, Vincent Gossett, the actual thief, she gets punished quite harshly, actually. Whipped, ear nailed to the pillory, then banished.
A nasty punishment for sure, but she wasn't facing death.
Not at all. But for Perrottine, Catherine, and Guillemin, even though the neighbors cleared them of theft, that little detail, not attending church, that was the opening.
The opening for the religious authorities to step in?
Exactly. The focus shifts completely. The secular court, the bailiff, and jurats, they seem almost ready to move on. But then the clergy intervene.
Right.
We actually have this letter reference. It's basically a formal handover from the bailiff, the lieutenant, and the jurats. They were the local officials, judicial types, to the dean, Jacques Amy, and the local curates.
Handing over what specifically?
They explicitly hand over the spiritual matter, the women's disobedience. Specifically, it mentions them contemning the Mass.
Wow, contemning the Mass. That's serious language for the time.
And the letter states this goes against the will of the monarchs, King Philip and Queen Mary. So this is a real pivot point. The theft charge fades and heresy looms.
It's fascinating how they draw that line, isn't it? Handing over the spiritual matter. Was that just procedure, or were they maybe washing their hands of a tricky religious case?
It's hard to say for sure, but the effect is the same. The scrutiny shifts entirely. Now the women are examined about their faith.
And what do they say? Do they defend their absence from church?
Their statement is interesting. They basically say they will obey the current king and queen and the church. They acknowledge they had followed King Edward VI's ordinances, previously the Protestant ones.
So it sounds like they're trying to comply, maybe acknowledging the change in regime.
It really does sound like an attempt to navigate the situation, to find a way to coexist with the reinstated Catholic order.
But it wasn't enough.
Apparently not. Despite saying they'd obey, they're imprisoned again while the dean, Jock Amy, decides what to do. And this is where the process seems to, well, really break down.
How so?
Because the dean and the curates, they condemn them as heretics before any formal examination of their faith happens in front of the bailiff and jurats.
Wait, really? So the religious court jumped the gun?
It certainly looks that way. Like, the verdict was already decided, regardless of the proper legal procedure involving the secular authorities. So while the theft issue was fading for the secular court,
the religious court had this whole other standard. Not attending Mass, contemning it, that was heresy under Mary.
Precisely. A capital offense in their eyes. So what did the bailiff and jurats do when they realized the proper examination hadn't happened? Did they challenge the condemnation?
Not exactly. They didn't overturn it. Instead, they just ordered that, okay, the women should be examined separately by the dean and curates.
Separately. Why?
Perhaps to prevent them conferring? Or maybe just procedural tidying up after the fact? But it underlines how flawed the whole thing was. They were examined, then sent right back to prison.
It feels like a foregone conclusion by this point.
It really does. Then comes July 14th, 1556. The dean and curates formally present their act and sentence to the bailiff, this time a man named Hillier Gosselin and other officials.
The official verdict.
Yes. Catherine Cotches and her daughters, Perrotine and Guillemine, are officially declared heretics. And they're handed over to the secular arm for execution.
How did the women react to that?
It's heartbreaking, really. They pleaded to see who had accused them. They asked, you know, what specifically have we done wrong? They insisted they weren't aware of offending the king and queen or the church, and they were still saying they were willing to obey.
It really highlights their confusion, doesn't it? Maybe a genuine lack of understanding of how far things had gone, or maybe just desperation.
Could be both, but none of it mattered. Their pleas were just ignored.
And the sentence was delivered.
Yes. Bailiff Hillier Gosselin delivered it, burning until ashes. And all their goods confiscated.
Burning. Standard for heresy then, but still horrific. Is the date certain?
There's a slight wobble in the records. Fox and some sources say the execution was July 18th, following a sentence potentially around the 14th or 17th. One local source mentions sentencing maybe later, like the 27th. But the outcome, tragically, that's consistent.
Did they try anything else? Any final appeal?
They did. They actually petitioned the king and queen, Philip and Mary, and their council, appealing to the highest power in the land.
Acknowledging the ultimate authority. Did it work?
No. Heartbreakingly, their appeal was just ignored, completely disregarded.
So then, the execution.
And the accounts, particularly Fox's, are just. They're brutal.
Right.
Three stakes are set up. Catherine, the mother, in the middle. Her daughters, Perrotine and Guillemine, on either side.
Was there any mercy shown?
Well, the intention was for them to be strangled first before the fire was really lit. A small mercy, as you say. But the rope broke.
Oh.
They fell into the flames alive.
Fox's description must be graphic.
It is. Unforgettable.
Yeah.
But the detail he recounts, the part that is just truly shocking, almost unbelievable, concerns Perrotine.
What?
Perrotine.
Yeah.
She was pregnant, heavily pregnant, it seems. And in the agony of the flames, her body literally burst open.
Oh, God.
And a child, a baby boy, fell out of her womb into the fire.
A birth amidst the flames. That's beyond comprehension.
But then, incredibly, for a moment, someone, a man named W. House, actually rescued the infant from the fire, pulled the baby out, laid him on the grass nearby.
Life literally snatched from the fire. There must have been a moment of hope. Shock.
You'd think so. This image of life emerging from that horror. But no, that hope was extinguished almost immediately and brutally.
How?
Bailiff Hillier Gosselin, the same official who passed sentence, he saw the rescued baby, and he gave the order.
No.
To throw the baby back into the fire.
He ordered the baby thrown back.
He did. Just an innocent newborn infant thrown back to burn.
Like, There are no words for that.
Fox uses stock ones. He says the infant was baptized in his own blood, calls the baby a martyr alongside his mother, aunt, and grandmother.
And the family must have been devastated.
Absolutely. Perrotin's brother, Matthew Couches, he later filed a formal complaint. Pointed out the sheer legal atrocity, aside from the moral one. 4 people were killed, but only 3 were ever condemned.
The injustice on top of the brutality.
Yeah.
It's just staggering. That specific act, throwing the baby back,
It
forces you to confront the absolute depths of intolerance, doesn't it?
It really does. The darkest side of human behavior.
Yeah.
Fueled by that religious certainty.
But the story doesn't quite end there, in the ashes.
No, it doesn't. History moves on. Queen Mary dies in 1558. Elizabeth I takes the throne and things change. Investigations were actually launched in Guernsey.
Into the executions,
yes, but also into other things. There were accusations flying around about embezzlement and misuse of funds on the island, too. A general cleanup, perhaps?
And were there consequences for the men involved? The dean? The bailiff?
There were. Dean James Amey, the one who condemned them as heretics. He was imprisoned for a time and he lost his position. Stripped of his authority.
And Bailiff Hillier Gosselin, the one who gave the order about the baby.
He was dismissed from his post as bailiff in 1562, so yes, removed from power. Although, he did later receive a pardon from Queen Elizabeth.
A pardon for that?
Yes. Politics and reconciliation under the new regime, perhaps. It suggests accountability was, well, maybe incomplete by our standards.
It's interesting, though. You mentioned earlier this might have had an unexpected effect on religion in Guernsey.
That's a fascinating, if grim, historical observation. It's believed these incredibly harsh executions actually helped fuel the growth of Calvinism, of Protestantism, in the Channel Islands.
How does that work? Such extreme persecution strengthening the persecuted faith.
It's a known pattern sometimes. Witnessing such profound injustice can galvanize a community, strengthen their resolve. It might even draw others to the cause, seeing the faith people are willing to die for and the brutality of the opposing side, a kind of paradoxical effect.
Right. Now, Fox's account is central here. Was it ever challenged?
It was. Later on, a Catholic writer named Thomas Harding, who was generally critical of Fox's Book of Martyrs, he did address this specific story.
Did he deny it happened?
No, and this is important. He didn't dispute the core events, the burning, the baby. His criticism was focused on Perrotin herself.
How so?
Harding argued that Perrotin was, in a way, responsible for her own child's death because she hadn't pleaded the belly in court.
Pleaded the belly? What's that?
It was an old legal custom. A pregnant woman condemned to death could formally declare her pregnancy to the court, which could lead to a stay of execution until after the child was born. Harding basically blamed her for not using this legal mechanism, so blaming the victim, essentially. It also assumes she even knew she could or felt safe doing so in that court.
Exactly. It raises questions about the legal processes, sure, but it shifts the focus quite dramatically. Fox, however, wrote a detailed rebuttal to Harding. He defended Perrotin.
What did Fox say?
He countered Harding's points, and interestingly, he revealed something else, that Perrotin was actually married.
Yeah.
To a minister, a Protestant minister named David Jors, back in King Edward VI's time.
Ah, so that adds another layer. Reinforces her connection to the Protestant faith they were being persecuted for.
Precisely. It contextualizes her beliefs and maybe her defiance or perceived defiance.
And this story, these names, Catherine, Guillemine, Perrotin, the infant, they haven't been forgotten in Guernsey. Not at all. It's a powerful testament, really. In 1999, quite recently in historical terms, Lavilio's church in St. Peterport put up a memorial plaque, specifically for the Guernsey martyrs.
That's significant. What does it say?
It lists their names, recounts the basic, horrifying details of their deaths, and the inscription really emphasizes their faith, their steadfastness, and, of course, the tragic fate of the infant. It firmly places their story within that larger narrative of the Marian persecutions, the many Protestants who died for their faith, as documented by Fox.
So, wrapping this up then, we've traced this truly disturbing path, started with a petty theft, a silver cup.
Which somehow spiraled into accusations of heresy.
We saw a shocking disregard for what we'd consider due process, even by the standards of the time.
Leading to an almost unbelievably cruel execution, especially as we've discussed the fate of Perrotin's baby.
And we've touched on the ripples, the aftermath, the investigations, the paradoxical boost to Calvinism, the way the memory is kept alive.
Yeah, reflecting on it, what really stands out is just the sheer grinding injustice, but also the power of belief, the willingness of these women to face that horrific end for their convictions. It's powerful, tragic, but powerful.
It truly is. So maybe here's something for you, the listener, to think about as we finish. What does this story from way back in 16th century Guernsey, what does it really tell us about the dangers of religious intolerance? Dangers that maybe still echo today.
And how does remembering events like this shape a community? How does it inform their identity, their history?
And maybe what's our responsibility looking back? How do we learn from these deeply troubling, deeply human stories from our shared past?
Thanks for listening to Guernsey Deep Dive. Don't forget to follow for the latest updates. Any questions or queries, email guernseydeepdive@gmail.com.